This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And I know we said that we were going to talk about Nurse this week, Douglas Aaron Yokosky's feature film, which has a lot of Star Trek people involved in it. But we're gonna push that back a week or so. And you never know what we're going to be talking about here on Stage 9. You know, we're like Steve Buscemi in Living in Oblivion. Sometimes you just have to roll with it. Right?
I've never seen Living in Oblivion, but I agree with that.
Oh, my God. You got to see it. It's amazing.
Living in Oblivion. All right.
Steve Buscemi is the director of like an indie film.
Yeah.
And it's him trying to film a scene, essentially.
Oh, really?
And all of the crazy stuff which happens. And it was a short film, which was very successful, and they expanded it into a feature film.
Okay.
And it stars like Catherine Keener and Peter Dinklage.
Wow.
And I think it's got to be one of his first movies. And Steve Buscemi is amazing. It's hilarious and awesome. And it's '90s indie cinema. And it completely captures what it's like to shoot '90s indie cinema, you know?
I am. I'm writing it down right now. Living in Oblivion. Okay.
Yes.
That
yes,
sounds good to me.
It's fantastic.
All right. That sounds good.
Yeah. But we're not watching Living in Oblivion today, but we are rolling with it. So,
yes.
what we're going to watch instead, or what we're going to talk about instead, is the first feature film written by Jesse Alexander. Now, Jesse Alexander, along with Aaron Eli Colite, wrote episode 4 of Discovery, which was the butcher's lamb cries for the
the butcher's knife cares not for the lamb's cry. Is
there
that right?
Go.
I think
yeah.
that's it.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds good. And yeah, you know, it's Halloween. It's, you know, October. Shocktober.
Yeah. Shocktober, yes.
I know that you're a big fan of the holiday, John. And I know that you to kind of like watch spooky movies in that time frame.
Very much so. I like watching a good scary movie. My wife and I got married on October 30th, as a matter of fact. And we actually had for our rehearsal dinner, we had a costume party.
Wow.
Actually, yes, where disturbingly I dressed as Anakin and she dressed as Leia. So, you know, unpack that one. But it's mainly because Amidala costumes are a lot harder to come by. And so at the very least, I was a Jedi and she was Princess Leia. So, you know, it counts.
That's cool.
Yeah, but big fan of the holiday. And so we're talking about Eight-Legged Freaks, which did you see this in the movie theaters when it came out?
Yes, I vividly remember seeing this in the theater for some reason. Because like Max and I were projectionists at a theater at the time, theater which did not get Eight-Legged Freaks, and our sister theater, which was a few towns over, maybe like a 40-minute drive from where we were at, they were getting it. And for some reason or another, we thought that this would be a great idea and a worthy movie to drive all the way to this other town to watch it the night before at like midnight when they screened their print, because you know, that's how badly we needed to see Eight-Legged Freaks. And wow. All I remember is, like, we were, like, one of, like, three people in there, and there was this one, like, 16-year-old kid who had just started working, who was extremely enthusiastic, who you could tell all of the employees at this theater just found to be incredibly annoying. That's my memory of watching Eight-Legged Freaks in the theater. Did you see it in the theater?
I didn't. One of the greatest fears in my life is spiders, actually. When I saw Arachnophobia in the theater, I practically had to be carried out. I watched Arachnophobia. I couldn't even have my feet on the floor. Like, I was literally balled up in my seat and couldn't move through the whole thing. And then saw it a second time. So unpack that one. And but when this came out, I was really intrigued because I, for some bizarre reason, love watching things that scare the hell out of me. And I was like, oh, giant spiders. Yeah, this is literally from my nightmares. This is right up my alley. But wound up chickening out basically because I was like, I can't put myself through this. And so later saw it on home video.
It is one of those movies where, like, I mean, you look at the poster and everything and you're like, okay, this is obviously kind of like an homage to the monster movies of the 50s, you know,
yeah.
Like them, I guess, would be the biggest one, right?
Yep.
Like, watching it again this time, like, even though the effects are super cheesy and everything, I was like, these are actually pretty gross. Like, I am yeah. kind of like, you know, they it is rather skin crawling at times.
Yeah, the one pleasant thing for me watching it the first time and watching it since is the fact that they sort of pulled the punch and made it fun. This, for me, Eight-Legged Freaks is the type of movie that I expected and wanted Snakes on a Plane to be,
yeah.
where it was still a good scare. It was still, you know, like you said, skin crawling, but at the same time, there was legitimate humor in it. Like, I actually laughed during it. And they had certain sound effects that they added with the spiders, like almost little giggles and stuff like that, that made it palatable, made you able to pull back and say, okay, just laugh now. It's okay. It's not real. And I think that it works. I mean, it's entertaining. And this is the type of scary spider movie I can handle. So, you know, gets good marks for me for that.
It's kind of like the Thunder Mountain of spider movies, you know?
Thunder Mountain. I haven't seen that.
No, I meant like The Ride at Disney World.
Okay. Well, I figured that Disney has every, you know, movie based on every single ride
probably,
that they have.
It probably does have a Thunder Mountain.
But yeah.
Like direct-to-video okay. movie or something. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it's like something that you can handle, you know? It'll be fun. It'll be fun. Don't worry about it. It's not too scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, it's one of those things where I didn't go into it, you know, looking to be scared necessarily. I went into it more kind of like looking to laugh, I guess, more than anything.
Yeah.
And I chuckled on occasion. You know, I think it's one of those things where conceptually I'm completely down with it. It's just I don't really necessarily know that it can sustain its joke for, you know, 90 minutes or whatever it is. Like, I see it and it starts and I'm like, yeah, hey, yeah, I'm into this. And then it just kind of keeps on going. And at some point I'm just like, okay, yeah, I get it now. I get it, guys. Are we wrapping this up now or what's going on? You know what I mean?
But see, I don't fault it for that so much simply because of the fact that any monster movie essentially is going to wear out its welcome eventually. You know, any slasher flick does, anything does. Oh, and
yeah.
So this makes up for it for me because it's well structured. There is a point where you're right. The joke doesn't play as well anymore. It's not getting the same type of laugh that it originally did, but it's well structured enough that I remain curious. Where are we going to go? How's it going to end? And I think that makes up for any sort of genre shortcomings that there might be or the joke playing itself out. At the very least, it's still constructed well as a movie plot. And so that, you know, that keeps me in it until the end.
I guess so. I don't know. I guess I wasn't that tremendously impressed by it. I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, where that's a problem with any, you know, sort of like slasher movie or anything like that. And I would agree with that, which I think is probably why most movies of that kind are not very good. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
That I mean, you know, everyone's talking about how great it is, you know? Did you see it?
No, I didn't go. It is a movie that I hate the title, and I hate the title It of the book, because I want to find some way to set it out so that I'm using capital I, and I can't do that. But
yeah,
no, I didn't go to see it. My buddy, who is also a big horror fan, his review came back to me as it's good and serviceable, but I think people are going crazy for it just because it's been so long since there's been a good serviceable horror movie released. Like it's not a found footage movie, and it's not Paranormal Activity or something like that. It's finally a horror movie. And so being good is good enough for people to go gaga for it. That's his take on it.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, to me, if you want to go see a good horror movie, there actually is one out right now. It's called Happy Death Day, and I highly, highly recommend it.
I have heard good things about that. Yeah.
Written by Scott Lobdell, by the way, the writer of basically all of the mid to late 90s X-Men comics. So, you know, hey.
Oh, hey. That's a good pedigree to have.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like with it, it's like whenever it reverts to like horror movie, you know, like here comes the scare, I'm just like, this is so boring. And yet, like the actual mythology behind it, like the character moments, when it's more, you know, Goonies than it is, you know, like Jason or whatever, like that's when it's really working. But there's a lot of boring, quote unquote, horror stuff, you know, mixed in with the drama or whatever you want to call it in it. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that movie is not very good. But
you know, it's funny, though, you say about the character stories, because there's a film that I rewatched recently to discuss actually over on Filibuster on Nerd Party, The Shining, which is a movie that I have taken every opportunity to kick over time.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the character thing, and this show is going to release after that comes out, so I'll go ahead and spill it here. I wound up loving it this time.
Yeah.
I've spent decades curb stomping The Shining as this boring thing, and I wound up watching it this time, and I think you're right. I haven't seen it, but it was so nice to see something that's just a straight character study sort of thing and take its time and not rely on a jump scare and or a build to, okay, it's been 20 minutes since we saw the clown, so the clown's got to come back now. It just is what it's supposed to be, and that I thought was just a, you know, great thing. But you know, Eight-Legged Freaks is what it's supposed to be too, which is just, it's a, supposed to be a cheesy horror flick with giant spiders.
Yeah, I admire it for that. You know, I admire it for being what it is, but I think that it's the type of thing which just doesn't hold my attention for its running time. It's weird because, like, I remember having a very similar reaction when I saw it in the theater. I remember thinking, like, I like what they did there, just not for that long, you know? And I had, like, almost the exact same reaction this time around. You know, I mean, the cast is good and everything. You got, you know, Kari Wuerer and David Arquette and, you know, Scarlett Johansson is in it. You know, it's a good cast. And, you know, they do a good job with this type of material. You know, I mean, David Arquette and Kari Wuerer in particular, I think, are sort of like masters of this type of material. You know, I mean, like David Arquette being in Scream and everything and Kari Wuerer being a staple of, you know, syndicated science fiction, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just, on the whole, it doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's more fair. I mean, it's serviceable. And it, you know, if you're looking for horror, it's not going to satisfy you. But, you know, if you're looking for something that's just sort of like a light take on things. Speaking of Arquette, though, when I was looking through stuff, apparently the title, he ad-libbed the line, "You eight-legged freaks," and that's how they titled the movie. And so I think that's the sort of thing that brings the energy to a movie that makes something like this work for me, is if I can tell that the actors are loose and having a good time, I'll plug into it, you know, despite any other shortcomings it might have. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's a fun thing to watch. You know, if you don't want to have horrible nightmares later that day.
I guess so. You know, Showtime did a whole like series in the 90s called, like, I forget what they were called, like drive-in whatevers or creature features or something. Okay. Where essentially what they did was they took titles from like 50s B movies and they handed them off to filmmakers, a lot of A-list filmmakers actually, and said, okay, make your version of this. Don't do a remake, but make the movie that you would make based on this title, which I guess is, you know, something that a lot of people would do back then, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we've got a title and a poster. Now go write us a movie, you know, that fits it.
That's the Gall and Globus model, actually.
Right. So, yeah. You know, they had, like, Road Racers, which is by Robert Rodriguez, and Girls in Prison by John McNaughton. And then the one which always stands out to me is Teenage Caveman.
Yeah, it is. I have a vague memory of this, but that does sound like that. But, you know, I would rather see something like this that is fresh and got some energy. And even if it doesn't, you know, hold your attention all the way through, or you think, oh, this is just a little bit too long, or, you know, maybe it could have been snazzier, I'd rather see more of this in the flow of things that is just honest about itself and not trying to, you know, I don't know, become a franchise or anything like that. Like, I like these sort of throwaway titles. And I know that sounds like a really dismissive way to refer to this, but, you know, it kind of is. Eight-Legged Freaks. You know, I'd rather see more of these sprinkled out instead of, again, the found footage or, you know, yet another final exorcism of something or somebody or haunted house movie. Bring back the monster flick. This is, you know, these are cool things.
And I guess kind of one of the challenges is that it almost sort of in some ways is reliant on people being familiar with the genre in the first place, which yeah. The further and further we get away from the 50s, the harder and harder that becomes. But, you know, I mean, certainly there have been, I do think that there is kind of like a sub-genre of, which is similar to this, even if it's not monster movies per se. It's the idea of like fun, usually like PG-13 rated horror movies, which are more about, you know, the joy of going to see a horror movie than it is about, right, you know, trying to completely, you know, terrify you or whatever. And
yeah.
I mean, I really do think, like, a recent example, Happy Death Day, really does kind of like fit that bill, only it's a slasher movie instead of like a monster movie. But yeah, check that out for sure.
See, monster movies in specific, you know, they had got that big budget Godzilla get released that Gareth Edwards did. And, you know, and you have this. Yeah, I think that there is a pervasive thing that's good about these movies is that they are always predicated on this initial plot point of damage to the environment and pollution are always at fault. And you have to wonder if for no other reason it winds up creating this baseline social consciousness about taking care of the environment into people. I know it seems silly to point to that with Eight-Legged Freaks, but it's essentially like, oh, toxic waste. And, you know, you might laugh at that and say, oh boy, another thing caused by toxic waste. But that whole thing of repetition, it gets in your brain and you think about it. And even if you're like, oh, that's a silly plot device, it makes you stop for a second and think, yeah, but, you know, pollution is bad. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes, I, you know, for that alone, I'd bring these types of movies back into the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, Godzilla, the original, was really, really, you know, big on that, you know, when you think about it. I mean, it was all about, you know, Japan's response to the fact that, you know, they had a couple of, you know, nuclear bombs dropped on them, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, it you're right that it does, you know, tend to have that sort of thing. And I think that's because a lot of these movies are sort of born out of the 50s, you know, when there was that nuclear scare and everything. And, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you look at Star Trek and what Star Trek does, it's the, you know, similar thing with, you know, social issues and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're seeing that on Discovery right now. I mean, this week's episode, I think, is very similar to some stuff which has been, you know, in the headlines recently. But yeah, you know, it's cool to see, you know, science fiction, horror. I mean, it definitely gives you room to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So Jesse Alexander, we talked about him, you know, before. We've watched a couple of things that he's done, including a couple episodes of Alias that he did, which starred Quentin Tarantino.
Yep.
And then we also watched his new show, I don't know, movie, The Saint, whatever you want to call that thing, which was a very interesting little
experiment. Let's call it an experiment.
Okay, yeah. But I mean, he's definitely a really good writer, you know, primarily working in TV, having done things like Hannibal and Heroes and, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, seeing him here get his start, you know, on the big screen with Eight-Legged Freaks, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was the Jesse Alexander episode, which was episode 4, and then we talked about how, well, which he wrote with Aaron Eli Colite. The two of them worked together on Heroes, along with Brian Fuller. Then episode 5 was Kemp Powers, which we discussed last week. Episode 6 was written by Ted Sullivan and Joe Manosky, which is pretty cool. Joe Manosky, back on Star Trek. I mentioned this
thing
on the commentary that we did earlier this week on Treks from the Edge, but Joe Manosky has written more episodes than all but 4 people in Star Trek history.
Yes.
He's written 55 episodes.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
You think of like Darmok, you think of Masks and everything, but like all of those like Voyager two-parters, like the 2-hour movie event things, you know?
Yeah.
Like he had a hand in all of those and everything. It's crazy, you know, how much stuff he's written. And it's always weird and cool. And episode 6 of Discovery is weird and cool too. And it was co-written by Ted Sullivan, who has not written any Star Trek up until now. And you know, we talked about his work on Supergirl a few months back with For the Girl Who Has Everything. So check that out. So the old and the new coming together to create new Star Trek. Directed by Douglas Arne-Yokosky, who, as we mentioned last week, directed Nurse, and who we will talk about in the near future. But, exciting stuff. Well, it's been fun talking about Eight-Legged Freaks today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
The hardest thing I've ever done, I mean, as a tie-in writer, reconciling canonical differences or apparent canonical differences is one of those things where as a tie-in writer, you learn, you see it, and instead of getting angry about it the way a fan does, you look at it and you go, oh, that's a story possibility. How do I explain that? What do I do with that?
The 602 Club.
I don't know. There's just something completely different about this movie than anything I've seen this year and maybe in a long time. And maybe it's just, I feel like this movie just takes the time to do all of that stuff. And it's not afraid to be art.
Warp 5.
And good to know that you have already failed one of my questions for Stump the Geek. There's 5 Zindi that are still alive and 1 species that's extinct.
He's not that bright.
Jot that down. I thought there were eight. I've always thought there were eight. See, it was confusing. I'm confused.
To the journey!
I kind of figured he would just be able to, like, make another mobile emitter for the doctor. Wouldn't he?
He'd use his nanoprobes for that.
Yeah.
Right, put some nanoprobes on the job. They'll make the doctor a new mobile emitter.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Lickety-split.
Can I have my mobile emitter? Oh, yeah. He never asked, though, did he?
No, he didn't.
If he'd asked him, he'd just been like, oh, yeah, here you go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone or iPad or Apple TV or the desktop iTunes app and get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and you can contact us in any number of ways. The best place to reach us is on the Babel Conference, where you can join the larger conversation. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That will come right to us. And you can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Castle Junkie out there on the internet. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And if you go on over to thenerdparty.com, you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing, who everybody here on Trek.fm may know from 602 Club and The Orb. And you can also find me co-hosting Great Shot Kid with you on thenerdparty.com.
Yeah, you can find me over there, and you can also find me on my website, CommentaryTrackStars.com, doing a show called Commentary Track Stars, and you can find me on Trek.fm doing The Edge, which is our disco show. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Chris Steftenagel and Jeff Sutter and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
Yes, we really appreciate your support. And if you want to be like Chris, Jeff, and Norm, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all the details, including perks like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our patrons' website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. You know, my Halloween season, I have to say, starts on Thanksgiving and it ends on New Year's Day, and I just love watching Christmas movies.
Like, oh, yeah.
I mean, I like It's a Wonderful Life and, you know, all the whatevers. And, you know, I know Die Hard has become mainstream. That used to be my go-to. But, like, I like watching, like, the really crazy stuff. Like, we should watch Reindeer Games with Sarek in it, you know?
I still have to see that. You've been after me for years to watch Reindeer Games. Consider it a date. I'm going to see Reindeer Games this year.
All right. All right. This holiday season, coming to you from Stage 9, Reindeer Games, starring James Frain as Sarek, sort of. ¶¶